All right, Leviticus, shall we? Do you want some ice? All right. Tony, pray for us, my friend, and then let's dive into, where are we, 19, I believe, ish? All right, so we are kind of off on the backside of Leviticus, if you will, kind of heading downhill. We saw the Day of Atonement yesterday, which I think is the highlight kind of this book, and obviously of the year within the midst of Israel. The rest of kind of what we're going to see are more kind of laws regarding certain things. Some of them are things that we saw in Exodus and that are repeated. Some of them will be repeated for a third time in the book of Deuteronomy. Some of them just feel like shotgun, like, do this, I want to do that, and whatever kind of end of an epistle, you know, say hi to so-and-so and, oh, do that. Some are going to be a little bit more ordered, okay, but that's kind of the idea. So we'll roll through, hopefully, the end of Leviticus today and walk through some of these laws, some concerning the people, some concerning the priests. Some of them are just daily life type things that they should and shouldn't be doing. Some of them are higher level, like overall things. So we'll kind of get into all of them, all right? So 19, let's pick up there. And just, again, for context, where are the people right now, by the way? Where are they physically located? Mount Sinai. Okay, so keep that in mind. All the way to Numbers chapter 10, they're at Mount Sinai. So since they parked the truck in Exodus 34, when Moses goes up the mountain, even before that, they had been at the foot of Mount Sinai, since like Exodus 15, like 19, okay? So 10 commandments, they've been sitting here. So this is just a one-year period all the way from them stopping at Mount Sinai all the way to Numbers 10. And then by the end of Numbers, we're going to carry through like another 40 years like that, okay? So just in context, remember, they're still sitting at the foot of Mount Sinai. They're receiving the laws from God. They've watched Nadab and Abihu die. They've watched now the commandments go forth for the Day of Atonement. Okay, they haven't done those things yet, but they've heard about the commandments to do them, all right? So that's the idea. All right, so more ideas on kind of just the sanctity of life and the day-to-day operations for the people of Israel. God's going to put some cool stuff in here, okay? Chapter 19, verse 2, speak to the sons, speak to the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy for I am holy. Okay, we mentioned that verse yesterday. Again, if it's not underlined in your Bible, it should be. Now you know. All right, so God is calling his people to be set apart and to look differently. And so much of what's in here is just man, I want you to live distinct from the people around you, not like the Canaanites, don't practice their ways, okay? And I don't want you to live in a bubble, but you need to live and act distinct, okay? Verse 4, turn from idols, okay? No worshiping idols. Things about peace offerings and the like in the following verses. Look at verse 9 and watch how God has kind of commanded. This is their welfare, their food stamp system, if you will, 9 and 10.
When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, neither shall you gather gleanings after your harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them to the poor and for the sojourners. I am the Lord your God.
So if you have your own field and you're a farmer, what's God's command about how much of it you can take for yourself? What do you have to leave? Yeah, the edges. So obviously in a square field, the idea is you can harvest that, right? But you leave this, you leave this, you leave that, and you leave that, right? Who's that for? Right, the poor, okay? So it's an odd thing in Israel, but you could tell how generous someone was by looking at their field, right? So if they harvested, you know, like all of it, and you walk into their field and there ain't nothing in the corners, you're like, man, you are a greedy, untrusting person, okay? If you walked into their field and they had harvested this much and left the rest of it, you could look at them and go, man, you trust God and you are very gracious to those around you, right? And the idea would be you would let people that were poor come glean in your fields. That was their food. That was the welfare system, right? It's not a handout. You got to go get it, right? What story comes to mind when you hear about a very generous farmer and a gal that got to reap in his field? Yeah, that's Boaz and Ruth. Okay, Boaz was an older gentleman that was very gracious and followed the biblical law. And he said, yeah, let him come, reap in my field. I'll take what I need, and I'll leave the rest to the people that don't have. Okay, so that was, there's your welfare system built into it, okay? You had to go get it, right? It's not, again, free, but that's the idea, all right? Look at 13. We've seen this, I don't think we've seen this one before, but here's God's heart for just being a man or a woman of your word. 19:13.
You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning.
What does that mean? The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until morning. Yeah. When? Timely, right? If you hire somebody, you pay them, okay? You don't make them sweat out their money. You do them right. If you put a contract with them and say, I'm going to hire you for the day to come work in my fields, then you pay them at the end of the day, okay? You don't rob from them. That's the implication. You shall not oppress your neighbor nor rob him. To not give him what is his is basically you're stealing what is rightfully his in his paycheck, okay? 14, you shall not curse a deaf man nor place a stumbling block before the blind, but I shall... but you shall revere your God. I am the Lord, okay? With people that are viewed in society maybe as less or maybe viewed as a hassle, that have certain handicaps, God says, no, we're not going to treat them differently, right? And the reminder for Israel is always, you remember what it was like in Egypt when you were oppressed and you were treated differently. We're not going to do that, okay? So God's going to walk through that with handicaps, with socioeconomic status, with racism. He's going to say, that is not okay. So you treat people fairly, like you would want to be treated. Look at 19:18. This is one of the maxims of the law, if you will. If you took the two Cliff Note versions of the entire law, the two Cliff Note verses, if you will, this is one of the two. Read 19:18.
You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people. You shall love your neighbor as yourself.
All right, so love your neighbor as yourself, okay? Love and treat others as you would want to be treated. Okay, what's the other Cliff Note version of the law, by the way?
Love God.
Love God, which is from where? The Shema, right? Deuteronomy 6. Okay, we're going to get to that in a bit, but that's the law. Love God, love others, period. Every other law is basically dealing with how you interact with God or how you interact with man, okay? So when the Pharisees of the day came to push on Jesus, these were the two verses that they threw in his face and said, you know, love God, love others. That was the whole, not prodigal son, what's the text I'm thinking of? Anyway, so in Luke 7:10-ish, thank you, that one. Yes, it's in Luke somewhere. Read your Gospels, it's good stuff. It's probably marked up in Shea's Bible, so I don't read that stuff, that's the New Testament. Anyway, I hear it's good. Let me know, okay? Then there's some odd text that you read, like 19. Read 19:19.
You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle breed with a different kind. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor shall you wear a garment of cloth made of two kinds of material.
You shall not wear a garment of cloth with two kinds of mixed material. Any of you guys have dry fit on that, you know, is like a polycotton blend? Or do you have, like... What in the world, right? Why can't I wear a, you know, denim jeans and a, you know, a polyester shirt or whatever? That was part of the regulations. Why would that be? Why would God say, your field is grapes, it's all going to be grapes, okay? If you got this kind of cow, you made it with that kind of cow, okay? And if you're going to wear cotton, wear cotton. What's that?
It's just the idea behind it.
Some of it. Yeah, maybe purity or, I don't know, simplicity, what else? Absolutely.
They look different
than
even what they wear.
Yeah, right? You're going to look distinct, right? So pagans have earrings. God says, don't have earrings, okay? Not because earrings are evil, but because the culture around you associates those with pagan worship or whatever, so don't have them. Those are symbols of something that is not godly, so don't do it, all right? So God is, again, calling them to live distinct. And some of these laws, again, you look at them and go, man, these just don't make a ton of sense, maybe to us today, and some of them need to be interpreted in that context as to where they were, but that's kind of the idea, okay? Another odd one, 1927, read that.
You shall not round off the hair on your temples or mar the edges of your beard.
Okay, so what does that mean? Anybody cut their sideburns recently? I'm in sin, right? Yeah? So I've marred the edges of my beard, or lack thereof, Jason. Sorry, dude. some here. Yeah. Yeah. take him outside! We will deal with this correctly. Right? But why would that be? Why not? Like, why can't you not have pork chops? I guess you can't have pork chops either way, so actually. Who knew? Yeah, why would that be? Why would God care? We just said it, right? So what do you think the pagans did? So put that in context today. What is that today? What is something external that you would look at and say, that's pagan? That is clearly associated with the worship of, or secular, or whatever it is, that if you did that, and I have no answer in my head, I'm just asking, how would we contextualize that today? Yeah, maybe like that. Yeah, immodest dress. I can see that. Can you guys think of anything that would be that distinct?
Some of the language you use, talking in a profane way.
Okay. That'd probably be bad. How about even something not that graphic? How about 1960s woman? Like, what was the big call to feminism back then? What did they, sorry, not to be graphic, but what was their thing? Yeah, no bra, right? Like that, I'm free. Like, I'm not restrained by some male. So, like, maybe that would be one that would be appropriate. Or in Paul's day, what was the sign? What was a sign of a woman that said, I am not going to come underneath the headship of my husband? What did she do to her head? Shaved it. Okay, so a woman that said, no, I follow the biblical rule of order. What do? I veil my head, right? There are churches today that would say, if a woman enters into a church and her head is not veiled, she's in sin, right? That's, I think, a contextual deal. I have friends in college that they took that as kind of one of those Romans 14 issues of like, man, I can or I can't, and they felt the conviction of, I need to do that out of respect for my God and respect for my, this was even a single gal, my future husband. I'm going to veil my head when I walk into church. So I had a friend of mine that would, she would wear a scarf and then she would just very casually lift it up, and it wasn't like a big ornate show and it wasn't like shame on you for not, but she felt the conviction of that shows that I'm underneath the headship of Christ and then ultimately the headship of my husband and the biblical order that God has set up, okay? So, again, I don't know what that looks like today, and it's kind of dangerous that maybe even we don't want to draw a line in the sand, but you get the idea, right? These were external signs that when you looked at someone, you went, you worship a different God than I do. And God said, don't do that. Don't look and be distinct in a guy that follows or a guy that follows me, okay? So, more of the same in here, okay? How about 28? Any of you in sin here? Yeah, exactly, right? No tattoos, right? I'm out, so... okay, so that was a distinctive of pagans. Again, maybe 3,000 years ago, and again, that time has changed a little bit. Yeah.
So, like, some of these laws we still try to follow, but we still have public opinion.
Yep.
Is it just like a personal thing?
Great question. Where are you guys at in Acts?
We're in Romans.
So you finished Acts. Mm-hmm. Good. You guys remember Acts 15? Jerusalem Council. Boys go on the first missionary journey, they come back, hey, there's Gentiles that are coming to faith, and the core disciples, what did they say they had to do? Every one of them has to get circumcised. And Paul said, whoa, time out. And Peter, we're like, why? These are Gentiles. That's not part of our law. And the argument, Kyle, it's a good question. We do need to figure out how do you assimilate the law into these things. Verse, just stay where you're at, I'll just read a bit of it. God knows the heart, testified among them, giving them the Holy Spirit, just as he also did to us. He made no distinction between us and them, cleansing their hearts by faith. Okay, so the way that we came to faith, i.e. Jews, and the way that they came to faith, i.e. Gentiles, was the same. And then he makes this interesting argument. Peter says, therefore, why would you put God to the test by placing upon the neck of the disciples a yoke, which neither their fathers... nor we have been able to bear. So Peter's answer is, you're putting a yoke on a Gentile that neither we nor our forefathers were able to bear. What yoke are they talking about? The law. Okay, so you're saying they came to faith, or they came to know Christ by faith, but to complete that, they now need to be yoked up with something that they can never, ever fully adhere to. We couldn't do it. Abraham couldn't do it, or maybe not Abraham. Moses couldn't do it, and everyone that came after him couldn't do it. Why would we yoke them up? And Peter's ultimate argument is no. Okay, the whole law is something that we are free to not follow in the sense that we have been freed to follow Christ. Now, do we still say there are things in the Ten Commandments we go, you know what, that's a great idea. Let's not murder. Let's not have sex with someone else's wife. Let's not blaspheme God. Like, those are all things that we so absolutely. But we don't follow them because it's the law. We follow them because we're now called to a higher law, right? And it's not that we pick and choose, but Christ came and fulfilled the law, and now we follow him fully in that regard, okay? So when you look at the areas of the law and say, well, there's hygienic law, there's dietary law, and there's just like general moral type law. I mean, you guys probably all have had pork or bacon or something in the last whatever, right? We're free to not do those things, right? I have something on that's a mixed garment, I'm sure, right? I shaved my sideburns a couple days ago, right? I'm not real worried about being in sin with God, okay? So there are certain laws we go, obviously, those are excluded. There are certain laws we keep, not because they are mandated in the Old Testament, because they are still right and moral in the call of a Christian today, okay? So the problem with the law is you've got to keep it all or not keep it all, and that's where you begin dividing deals, okay? So you take like a Seventh-day Adventist church, okay? They would say the right day to worship God is on Saturday because that is when the Jews worship God. So they have church on Saturday, and if you have church on Sunday, you are in sin. It's like, well, okay, so are you going to believe the rest of the law as well? Because, I mean, that's fine, but you can't pick and choose which laws you want to obey, okay? So Peter's ultimate argument moving forward with the Gentiles was, man, that's not their yoke to bear. That was ours. We couldn't obey it. That system's broken. See, also Hebrews. And it was there for a purpose, but it was appointed to Christ.
Couldn't someone make the argument, though, that we are still picking and choosing? So, like, if we don't murder, but we don't, or we don't, but we take our guarantee.
Right. And to a degree, we do, right? So Paul, and even more so, the Old Testament's one thing, but New Testament, right? Do you realize we are commanded 5 times in the New Testament to greet each other with a holy kiss? 5 times, okay? It's mandated. It's not a suggestion. It's a command, okay? So you were to greet a member of the same sex, or appropriately, that's how they would do it, right? Like when you're in France, you guys, that's how they greet each other. No one greeted me that way. I think you're all in sin this morning, right? Well, why would we say, no, we're not, but yet 5 times in Scripture, New Testament, you're commanded to do it. Are we picking and choosing which laws we want to obey? Right? Well, the idea is, in their culture, that was culturally appropriate, right? In our culture, I would have slapped you, right? More than likely. Or my wife would have pounded on you, okay? We would say that's not appropriate. So in our culture, it's, hey, give me a pound, shake my hand, say what's up, right? In a job interview, we're going to be a lot more formal and shake someone's hand in a certain way. And if it's a buddy, you know, you drop the rock. And if it's someone I know really well, I'll smack them on the rear end. Whatever, right? So I can do that with Shay. Some of you would, like, don't do that, right? There's a cultural context to how we greet each other. So that's part of how we have to look through the lenses of Scripture. Same thing with the veiling issue, right? Is that, what was the purpose of a woman veiling herself? Is there another way today that we do that? Maybe it's not as clear, but you know what I mean? So that's the sticky part of, you know, how we have to look at the law as well, okay? So chew on that. But my view of the Old Testament law is it hasn't been abolished, but it's been fulfilled. We need to be aware of it, but we're not called to follow it in order to gain God's favor. The moral part of the law certainly holds true today, but not in the same, not maybe for the same motivation, if you will.
What was the verse
of the yoke? Acts 15:10. Okay, so that's a good one to go to. So that's Peter's argument. And by the way, that's Peter's like last hurrah. He comes in and bangs the pulpit and says, no, we're not going to yoke the Gentiles. And then it's like, man, Paul, right? And Peter goes, like, fades into to darkness. So, okay? So, good stuff to remember, huh?
Mumbling.
All right, back to Leviticus. Where are we? So, okay, so just that's a great something you guys will need to wrestle with the law, okay, the areas and how we are to handle those today, okay? So just be careful that we don't pick and choose in a way that's not appropriate, okay? So, yeah, it's interesting, too, on that note. Where's the verse? Flip real quick to 20:13. Speaking of picking and choosing laws, Jane, read that. Okay, so what is this dealing with? Homosexuality? What is the punishment for homosexuality in the New Testament? How about back up and go to 10? It's funny which ones the church historically or some sections of the church have said, yeah! How about 10? You ever seen a church picketing for that, right? Adultery, let's kill them both too. It's like, well, it's funny how we raise one issue above the other, okay? They're both true. God says, no, that's not proper and that's not proper. So kill them all, right? And that obviously doesn't bring great glory to God's heart. He's not pleased with that. But we pick and choose sometimes what sin issues are more important than others. And a church will protest homosexuality, which they should take a stance on it, but they're not going to protest immoral heterosexual relationships were, in God's eyes, are equally as wrong, right? So, and the verses in between there talk about other areas that are equally as wrong, okay? But it's just, again, we pick and choose. So we need to take stances on stuff, especially where the New Testament commands us to, in areas that have not been, that maybe haven't changed, if you will, but we got to make sure that we adhere to all of it or none of it, okay? Yeah.
So, the Old Testament, they were commanded to, have that capital punishment and carry out God's judgment. So when Jesus came, I guess kind of changed that, at least for religious type stuff.
Yeah.
Do we have kind of a picture of why that is? It's a big change.
Yeah, that's a great question. With the religious stuff, I think that did change. I think we see a movement towards authority being given to government. That's established by God in the New Testament, that Romans 13 argument of that authority has been given to government that we're to obey. They have the ability to carry out those things, and in my opinion, all the way up to capital punishment is still biblically okay. I think in this day and age, there was a bit more of a self-governance about them. So there was no, Moses was the guy, but there was no system set up. Now society has grown. The New Testament addresses those things with how those structures are to be put in place, and then God says, look, I'm in charge of it all anyway. So, we certainly don't see the same punishment for crimes, maybe if you will, but we're still called to obey government, and government has been given that authority. So, yeah. That's a great question. I have no idea. So, what an awful job. We see that later, kind of the vendetta type deal. Yes, it was allowed, but it never went well. We'll see that in David's day. It's a nightmare. So
wouldn't the person that is justly carrying out killing this person, would they have to flee to the city of refuge?
They could. Yes, that was an option. We saw that in the text. Not yet. Killing that person? No, you're good, because that's eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. We see that in, it's coming. It's in, I read it this morning. But that concept is laid down. So no, that would be a different situation. That's executing justice, so you're not, that the executor would not have to be, right. So, okay. So good questions, all right? So. We don't have record of that stuff in terms of, it's not written in the scripture as to how they did that. There's lots of laws that God said you should do this, and they didn't, OK? Okay, we'll look at one in particular this morning where God said, you guys need to do this, and we have zero record. In fact, we have a reference later in 2 Chronicles that basically says, y'all never did, and I'm going to make you pay for it. So they pick and choose like we pick and choose.
I mean, not shortly after this, too, was the guy who breaks the Sabbath and killed him on the spot.
Yeah, that's in, where is that? No, it's in Leviticus. Yeah. Top left-hand corner. Dang it. We'll find it. Dang it. Yeah. Yeah, there's a guy that curses God outside the camp, and they bring him back in and stone him. So, okay. Hello. So, yeah. Okay. How about, let's just keep rolling. Okay, you guys can get a feel for some of these. We won't go through them all, obviously. 21, laws concerning priests. Okay, these are standards for them. We read kind of this with Aaron and his sons, and they're kind of their day in the sanctuary. Look at verse 1. No one shall defile himself for a dead person among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest to him, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, his virgin sister who is near him. Meaning if somebody dies and you need to leave your duty while you're performing your priestly duties, you can go for your nearest kin, but after that, like you're out. You're not, this is more important, okay? And in Aaron's case, when his sons died, they said, listen, y'all don't leave, period, or I'll kill you. So this is way more important. So there's a higher call in Israel in being a priest and the requirements that God put on them. So he kind of walks them through more of that stuff. How about 13? Can a priest marry? How about that? He shall take a wife in her virginity. Now, there's rules. A widow, a divorced woman in 14, one who's profaned by harlotry, these he may not take, but rather he is to marry a virgin from his own people. So you can marry as a priest anyone you want to in Israel so long as they're a virgin, right? Can't marry a Canaanite, you can't marry a divorced woman, priest can't be a kinsman redeemer, okay, that's not his job, okay, but he can marry a virgin woman, okay? So again, y'all figure out where that tradition started as to why priests can't marry today, but clearly in Scripture they can, okay? So in 18 and following, there's the priest, because of what they represented, there was a high call on who could be a priest. So if you had a deformity, verse 18, if you were blind or lame or disfigured, if you were hunchback, a dwarf, if you had in 20 eczema or scabs or other things you can read on your own, okay, you could not be a priest, okay? So if you were a eunuch, would be the proper terminology. Layla, stop laughing. I'm teasing. There was a high call, okay? So you could not be deformed in any way. All of you read 20. Let's get it out now. It's like dealing, dealing with fifth graders. I was, you know what? No, I'm not going to tell that story, actually. Yeah, anyway. I was teaching fifth graders how to repair a bike, right? So there's like 10, 15, whatever, fifth grade boy standing around me, and we're dealing with a bike, and we're dealing with screws and nuts. So, nut, and they're like, right? And for a minute, they're all giggling. And I'm like, really, guys? Like, and in my head, I'm thinking, I bet they're going to laugh at this inappropriately. And I'm like, what other word is there for, I'm like, dang, I can't think of any. Like, crap. So, anyway. So, yeah. So, anyway, yes. The teacher finally had to come over and like, boys, stop laughing, you know. It's like, jeez, I forget what it's like to be a fifth grader. Anyway, okay, so there you go. So again, high call to be a priest, okay? How about this, verse 3, okay, we've seen this before. If any man among you, this is specifically to the priest, and your descendants throughout your generations, 22:3, sorry, approaches the holy gifts with which the sons of Israel dedicate the Lord. Meaning if you're dealing with an offering from somebody in the congregation, and you as the priest are unclean, that person shall be cut off before me for the Lord. So again, the whole idea of a priest having to get right before God before he can do anything of service is a high call. Okay, so 22 is more of the ideas of the priest. 17 and following is the ideas of offerings and things that they had to do, and just kind of repeat of stuff that we've read in terms of the quality of the offering. It can't be defected. You can't take a baby away from its mom and offer that as an offering until after 8 days. Okay, so God had some things written in the law that made that humane, if you will.
Could a priest do his own
That's a great question. I would assume another, but we don't see anything with how that specifically would work. Do we have a Ronin list yet? Throw that on the Ronin list. Who's keeping our Ronin list? Okay, that's a great one to ask him. How do priests worship, you know? So in that regard, when they sin, how do they, be a good one. Ronan will know the answer to that, okay? Yes, ma'am.
Yesterday we were talking about how the priest would offer the bowl for his own atonement.
Yeah, it would be. That's a good point. I wonder, those were for specific days, and I guess some of them were outside of that when they started. So yeah, I guess, yeah, like on a day-to-day interaction, I don't know how that worked. Like, are you just, like when you're off, the priest would rotate through their duties. Like when you're just Joe Priest that's not working that day and you blow it, like do you got to, I don't know, that's a good question. But yeah, we do see evidence of that. It's a good observation. We need to give you a very large animal. Yeah. If they're anything like me, then yes. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Value, I think, is the biggest thing. So God won't let you use leftover three-legged, one-eyed sheep, you know. Right? You know, you bring me your first and your best, okay? Chapter 23 and following, this is the schedule that we looked at yesterday, the feast and festival schedule. That's what this is, okay? So it's all kind of written out. We see a couple things mentioned in here that we haven't talked about yet. We're going to see the Sabbath talked about and the sabbatical year talked about, okay? Yeah, we'll skip most of this. Flip way over to chapter 25, okay? All this, again, is laws that we've seen before. Huh?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Jubilee. This is God's law concerning the Sabbath year. So this is, again, in an agrarian culture. Think about the significance of this, okay? 25:2, speak to the sons of Israel. When you come into the land, here's how you're going to operate. Verse 3, 6 years you shall sow your field, 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather your crop. But during the seventh year, in verse 4, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard, okay? So 6 years on, as a farmer, the seventh year, you can do nothing, okay? Your harvest aftergrowth, verse 5, you shall not reap. You shall have your grapes untrimmed. So, like, even if they grow during that seventh year, you can't touch them, okay? You let the land rest and lie fallow. The idea was twofold. One, the land needs rest, right? That's why you see farmers even here rotate crops. So you'll see them, you know, be driving down Shepherd one day, and then all the crops are gone, and they plant something else. Well, that crop strips nutrients from the ground, and when you put a different crop in, it actually lives off the nutrients that, you know, so that's the idea. And what else is it a huge test of? Their faith, right? How are we going to eat? Well, God says basically that he knew they would ask that question. He's basically saying in 12 and following that you're going to eat for 3 years off that crop. So during the sixth year, that 6 years crop's going to provide for you. It's also going to provide for you during the seventh year when the land is fallow, and then you'll plant on the eighth year, but until you get a crop at the end of the eighth year, you got to eat off year six's crop. So 6, 7, and 8, one crop has to sustain you for 3 years. That's crazy, okay? Turn real quick to 2 Chronicles 36, and here's how Israel apparently handled this. Last part of 2 Chronicles. This is right before Israel gets taken into captivity. Look at verses 20 and 21.
You took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his son until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia.
Okay, so this is speaking of the king of Babylon who brings the people into servitude to him. Okay, keep going. Okay, so the land will now enjoy its Sabbath, meaning it looks like Israel never did this. They skipped all the Sabbath years. So they said, you know what? For every year you skipped, or every 7 years, I'm going to take that year back from you. I'm kicking you out of the land for 70 years. OK, Okay, so from the time they got booted until the time Nehemiah came back in to rebuild or with Ezra, that's a 70-year captivity. And God says, I am going to redeem the land. It's going to get its rest like it should. And instead of every 7 years, it's going to get 70 straight years. So it looks like, you know, every 7 years they should have done that. You do the math. 490 years, Israel never took a Sabbath. They never did this. And God said, it's going to come due one day. They didn't get immediate punishment, but it looks like that's why God put them in captivity for the amount of time that he did, because they didn't obey the law. He said, great, kick you out of the land, and I'm going to get what I want. Okay, so that's that. Okay, not only were they called to celebrate a Sabbath year, they were called to celebrate a year of Jubilee. Okay, the year of Jubilee happened every 50 years, and basically you took the Monopoly board, and you dumped it over, and then you started a new game. Okay. So if you had bought and sold property, if you had bought and sold people, everything that you accumulated, you gave back. Okay, so if you had been in financial hardship and you had sold your land in order to pay bills, that land came back to you, right? So for all the people that are in debt, they're like, heck yeah, right? I get everything back. For all the people that were like, you know, Boardwalk and Park Place and charging ridiculous rent, they obviously didn't want to do that, okay? And it doesn't look like they did that either, okay? But God said, listen, there are no monopolies. We're going to make sure this is fair. So listen, you can buy and sell property, but at the end of 50 years, the board gets wiped clean, okay? Everybody gets their $1,500 to start the Monopoly game again, and we go, okay? And the idea, God's saying, it's all mine. The people, the land, everything in it is mine. You don't own it. You're stewards. So I'm going to allow you to steward it. But at the end of the 50 years, you give it back. Okay, that's called the year of Jubilee. And as best we can tell, Israel never did that either. Okay, so obviously the
every 50.
Yep. So 49 years, and then in the 50th year, you wiped everything clean. Okay, so that is the year of Jubilee. Okay, so there you go. All right. Chapter 26. We'll just kind of move over to there. This is a pattern that we're going to see. We saw a little bit in Exodus 24. We see it here, and then we'll see it even more so in Deuteronomy 28 and following. This is the blessings and cursings of the law. And it's a, if you, then I, on a good thing, right? If you obey the law and you do these things, here are the benefits that you're going to see, right? If you choose not to walk with me and you do not do these things, here are the curses that come with the law, okay? So basically 26:1-13, is the, here's all the great stuff that happens, right? Verse 3, if you walk in my commandments and keep my commandments so as to carry them out. Verse 4, I'll give you rains in their season. The land will yield its produce. Your threshing floor in verse 5 will last until the grape gathering. Verse 6, I will grant you peace in the land. Like, it's all wonderful stuff. Like, I'm going to take care of you guys. Just walk with me and your needs are going to get met. You won't have enemies. Okay, your barns will be full, right? This isn't a prosperity gospel per se. It's a promise to say, listen, if you walk with me, God says, I will take care of you, okay? Verse 14, however, if you don't, verse 16, I will appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption and fever that will waste away the eyes and cause your soul to pine away unless you shall sow the seed uselessly. And all the way through the end of chapter 26, notice how much longer the cursing portion is than the blessing. He basically says, these are all the things that are going to happen from you. You're going to have enemies. You're going to be like putting money in, like Haggai says, purses with holes in them. Your wine vats may as well have holes in them as well. The idea is you don't walk with God and you're not going to reap the blessings of the land that's ultimately mine. Okay, you will see the prosperity gospel teachers come to portions like this and say, see, if you're sick, you're in sin. If you don't have money, it's because you don't trust God. And they take the law and, again, pick and choose which ones they want to follow. And, of course, they're loaded and healthy and, right, I don't know what, you know, Joel Osteen does when he gets sick. I guess he doesn't go on camera, so, because then he would be in sin. But you see that line of thinking improperly interpreted in the New Testament times because they don't see the change. And this isn't a promise to everyone. It was a promise to Israel that God would bless them if they obeyed. And he's going to curse them if they disobey. It's as simple as that. Okay? So that's the idea there. All right? 27, last chapter of Leviticus, is about kind of the above and beyond laws, if you will. We'll see some of those in Numbers. Like there were some like vows that you could take that were above and beyond the ordinary. You could do some crazy stuff like tithe your house to God, things like that. In 27, those are mentioned. So these are the These are the extra credit laws, okay? These are for the A-plus students that all sit on the front row, like my wife and daughter, that panic and they get 97s on tests, okay? So you three can read chapter 27. For the rest of us normal people that made B's and C's, y'all don't worry about it, okay? All right? So that's Leviticus, okay? So C's for degrees. So that's the idea, all right? So here's what I want you guys to do, okay? I want you to chart the book, okay? However you want to do it, but I want to see on a page or something that you can effectively reproduce and hand to your life group girls or whatever, Leviticus, okay? And I want you to show me the movement of the book, how it fits together, your chapter headings and summary headings and titles or whatever, and other pertinent information that you see as helpful, okay? So again, you don't need to drill down to like 500 feet on this, but you need to show me kind of big picture, okay? And again, I would encourage you guys to start the process without using a bunch of commentaries or, you know, downloading the Wells chart in Leviticus, as good as it is, okay? Start the process on your own. Get an idea of where you want to head. Confirm that you're not crazy, you know. If you said the most important part of the book is some random deal and it didn't, you know, no one else agrees with you, you know, there's a good chance you could be wrong, right? So use those, but come up with something that's yours, okay? The idea is when you're able to see a book like that, you don't own it until you can teach it, and that'll help you kind of assimilate it, okay? So let the bargaining begin for how long you guys get to do this project. I'm gonna vote no on that. It's the 17th, March 1st, 6 weeks. I expected something out of that, like from Jane. You guys have a lot of assignments right now. Valentine's, I hear a Valentine's vote. A month.
Man.
You can actually do it before Valentine's if you want, right? So the idea, by the way, guys, just in case you haven't been clear on this, is not to wait until the 13th and stay up all night, okay? So I live with overachievers in my home that have to have assignments done a month before they're due. All right. I will give you to the 14th of February because I am so gracious, okay? They're due that morning when you come in, okay? You can email them to me, but they need to be in my inbox by 6 in the morning on Friday. So if they're digitally, email them, that's fine. And again, these aren't going to be graded. I just want to see them, and I want to see that you guys put some effort into them, okay? I would encourage you guys, by the way, as you do this, digital is usually better. Don't handwrite a bunch of stuff because then you can change it later and tweak it and go, you know, I don't like that. So I get a bunch of charts that are old that I don't like anymore, but I can't change them because I wrote them on a manila folder, okay? Nothing wrong with it, but you can't tweak it. So use Microsoft Word, use Excel. Mac's got some great stuff. Yeah, you're not going to get downgraded for using that, but anyway, okay? So February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day, and have your chart ready, okay? Good? All right, we're 3 books into this thing, and more than halfway over, so we got some moving to do. You guys want to do some numbers today, shall we? Yeah! All right. Let's do some numbers. Okay, this one I will give you up front, okay? So, theme of Genesis was what? Sovereign election, okay? Exodus. Sing the song. Deliverance. Okay. Or redemption, either one. Okay. Leviticus. I like that one. Okay. Holiness, sanctification, be set apart. Okay. I think something in that neighborhood is fair. Okay. If y'all see something else, convince me of it. Okay. Numbers. Theme of numbers. Chastening. Okay. This is all about Israel, put your hands on the chalkboard and God's going to spank you for 40 years. Okay. This is the book where God is going to put their, he's going to test who they are. Okay, he's going to find out what's inside and he's going to get it outside. Okay, so he's going to put them in situations where you can't fake it anymore. The pull yourself up by the bootstraps mentality and really just have a positive attitude. He's going to put them in difficulty to show them who they are, who he is. So this is all about the chastening of God. Okay, so, wanderings is what they're going to do, but I don't know that that's the theme, so I would kind of go with something along those lines, okay? The breakdown of the book is actually really easy, okay? 36 chapters, chapters 1 through 10, are all about preparation. Okay? We're going to watch God tell them, hey, you're going to be moving in the wilderness. Here's how we're going to do it. Okay? The book of Numbers is a lot about numbers. 1 through 10, we're going to count a bunch of people. Okay? How many people from Judah? Okay, how many people from that dude's family in Judah? How many people from that guy's subfamily in Judah? Okay? And we're going to count everybody for 10 chapters. Muscle minutes. Okay? So they're going to get ready to move. Remember, they're still sitting at Mount Sinai. They haven't gone anywhere. So until we hit chapter 11, they're still sitting there. Okay? And then 11 through 25, right? Jace is the old generation. Okay? The focus of those chapters are all about the old generation. And by old generation, I mean the generation that was 20 and above coming out of Egypt. Okay? God is going to deal with these people. Okay? What ultimately happens to this group of people? They all die, right? Why? Because they're disobedient chumps. They don't believe God. There's a few exceptions, but for the most part, man, they are grumbly, they are whiny, they are a lot like me. Okay? And I would have fallen in that generation and would have been buried in the sand as well. Okay? Then, in chapters 26 through 36, we're going to deal with the new generation. So, those of you that left Egypt that were 20 and under, that maybe didn't get the laws or you weren't viewed as an adult yet, God is going to have to repeat his desires in the law, which is why we have Deuteronomy. Okay, Duat Nomos is the second law, so it's a repeat of Exodus and Leviticus. Okay, so we're not going to spend a ton of time in Deuteronomy because y'all have heard it and you didn't die halfway through, so we're good. We don't have to reteach you again, unlike these other people. Okay, so that's the book of Numbers. Okay, God is going to chasten the people. Okay, he's going to teach them his ways. They're going to get ready to move. 11 through 25, these people are going to test God, test God, test God, test God. He's going to say, I'm done. You're all dead. You can die here because that's clearly you want to be away from me. I will raise up a new generation. They will go into the land because they believe me. Okay, so it's a sad story because of all the people that should have seen God and loved God and the miracles and who he was. God is deeply pained by this group of people because of their attitude. Okay, they are remembered in the book of Hebrews as the unbelieving generation. So, and they all, to a man, basically die in the wilderness, except Joshua and Caleb and a couple of them that are believers. We see a few, okay, but for the most part, they were terrible. Yeah, he is, he's just working them over. He's turning the screws. He's putting them in difficulty. So, yeah, so he's humbling them. That's a good way to look at it as well. So, chastening with an H. How do you spell chastening? C-H-A-S-T-E-N-I-N-G. Not chase with a C-H-A-S-E. Not that one. Chastening. Is that right? I can't spell, so you guys figure out. Okay? So, if there's a better thesaurus word, find it. Thesaurus. What's another word for thesaurus? Okay, cool. So, obviously, here's what we're going to do. We won't read all of this, but I want to point out to you, obviously, in 1 through 10, we're numbering all these generations. Okay, so we're going to look at the people, or not the generations, the people that are in this generation. All right? But there are some things that we will look at in detail. All right? Ready? Okay. Here are the people that we're going to count. Okay, chapter 1, verse 1, let's pick up there. And this is the command given from God to Moses at the foot of Mount Sinai. Okay, verse 2, this is what he asked Moses to do. Somebody pick up there.
Take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male head by head. From 20 years old and upward, all Israel who are able to go to war, you and Aaron shall list them.
Okay, so who are we counting? Men who were 20 years and older who were able to go to war. Okay, so the idea is that would exclude the Levites are not going to get counted in this. They're going to get counted separately. So men 20 years older who are able to go to war. Okay, of this, you guys can see each family is counted. Now, the reason that this is important is we know how many left Israel. And then we're going to find out how many, when God kills this generation, what's going to happen after that, okay? So, each family is brought in here. You guys can see kind of the individual numbers. For instance, verse 20 and 21 talks about Reuben. Reuben has 46,500 men over the age of 20 who were able to fight and go to war, okay? Simeon, Gad, I mean, you guys can roll through the whole list, okay? We won't, but there they are, okay? In verse 45, here's the summary. Here's what we get, okay? So this is the total amount of people that are coming out of the land, fighting males above 20. Read that. Or just 46 will work. All right, so we got just on the high side of 600,000 males above 20, okay? So you take that number and you say, okay, that's conservative. Let's double that and assume that there's this 50-50 population with men and women. So we got 1.2 million adults over the age of 20, okay? So to say that maybe there's a couple chitlins in the mix of that is probably safe. So anywhere from 1.2 million to 3 million people is a pretty safe number of how many people are in the wilderness right now, okay? That's a lot of bodies, okay? And they're broken down by each one, okay? So you get the idea that we've counted all of them. So it's odd, right? The census is a good thing. God commands a census to be taken of his people, right? We're going to see David do that later in his career for the wrong reasons, and God's going to put David's hand on the chalkboard and spank him for doing it, okay? So it's not that it's wrong to count your people. David's motivations later are going to be wrong. God wants to know what they're dealing with, okay? So that's the Adira, all right? The Levites, verse 47, were not numbered among them by their families or their fathers' tribes. They don't get counted, okay, because they're not men that are qualified to go to war. Their job is different. 50, you see their job. You shall appoint Levites over the tabernacle, the testimony, over its furnishings, and over all the belongings of the that belong to it. They shall carry the tabernacle. They shall take care of it. And they shall camp around the tabernacle. Okay, so their job was centered around the tabernacle and the worship of Israel. Carry, camp, and care. Okay, so if you like your repetitive C's, God gave you some right there. Okay, so they didn't go to war. All right. The Levites, verse 53, shall camp around the tabernacle, the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel. Meaning, if we don't have them and they don't intercede on your behalf as the other 12 tribes, it's a bad day. Okay, so they are there to make sure that there is no wrath from God, that your sins have been atoned for and taken care of. Okay, now, chapter 2 is all about their positions as to how they camp. Okay, so again, you get 3 million people in the wilderness, there has to be some sense of order. Okay, this isn't the Oklahoma land rush. Every time they move, God would say, this is how you're going to move. And again, we get 10 chapters on how many people, how do you camp, who leaves first, where am I in relation to Judah and Simeon, right? So it's, God cares about these details, okay? So again, at the center of the camp, you've got the tabernacle and the Levites that were right outside of them. And then you can see literally God will give them their places to where they camp. Look at verse 3 of chapter 2. Read that. So this is the first guy mentioned, okay, I won't kill you with how do you say any of those names, okay, but who's the leader right now? Who's the guy that camps first? Judah, right? So the tribe of Judah is kind of the recognized leader, okay? We saw that all the way back to Genesis. He's the guy, okay? So on the east side, you see Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Okay, you guys don't necessarily need to know all these, but they would have camped on the east side, and then you had three tribes on every side, okay? And then the Levites would have been kind of right outside the camp, okay? So immediately in vicinity of the tabernacle, okay? So three on every side, 12 camps or 12 tribes, plus the 13th being Levi.
Did people intermarry between the tribes?
Yes.
Yeah,
and we're going to see a problem with that at the end of the book of Numbers. There's a family that was like, hey, we had land, okay? My dad had land. He died, has no sons. If dad gives us the land and we marry a dude from Reuben, then all the land goes to Reuben. God's like, oh yeah, that's not good. Or Moses, you know. So there's a, the daughters of Zelophehad come with that issue and say, hey, our dad died in the wilderness. He was an unbeliever, okay? We got his land. What do we do with it? How do we marry? And God's going to say, you know what? God's ultimately going to fight for women's rights in the midst of that and treat them in a way that was unheard of in that day and age. Okay, so kind of cool. But yes, they could intermarry. The problem was, what do you do with the land in that situation? Yeah, no. They were wide open to do that. So they were encouraged to marry within Israel, anyone within Israel. Okay, so yeah, that was fine. They are these group of gals. The solution for them is going to be marry within your tribe. That keeps it simple. So they were all virgins at that point, and God said to keep it simple, make sure the males are from, I think it was Judah, and that just yeah. So that was their answer to that. But outside of that, yeah, you can marry any Israelite. As could the priest, by the way, right? The priest could marry anyone in. They didn't have to marry a daughter of Levi. They could marry, you know, daughter of Simeon if they wanted to. Didn't matter, okay? So chapter 2 is all about how they camped, okay? So if you want to have a crazy, inspirational, quiet time, there's good stuff in there, okay? I will let you read it on your own. I don't want to steal pleasure of that, okay? Now, chapter 3, rather, here are the Levites, okay? We're going to break them down now into kind of subfamilies, and each family within the tribe of Levi has a different job, specifically with the tabernacle, okay? So just because you were from Levi didn't mean you get to do all the specific jobs. They were broken down specifically with Levi's sons, okay? So, let's see. 3:12, we kind of read this idea before. Instead of God taking all the firstborns like he said he was going to do out of Exodus, he takes the whole tribe of Levi before. So he says, behold, I have taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel instead of every firstborn, the first issue of the womb among the sons of Israel. So the Levites are all mine. Okay, so the Levites have basically been tied to God. And again, as a normal dude or dudette from Israel, you would look at them and say, man, you took my place. Thank you. So the idea was you revered and respected them. Okay. There were three families, sons of Levi, that are going to have special jobs, okay? Look at verse 17, and here are the three sons that all have specific duties in regards to the tabernacle, okay? Their names are Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, okay? So these three guys are going to get duties divided up between them in regards to how they camp, what they took, and what they didn't take from the tabernacle, okay? Yes, ma'am. 3:17. Okay, we'll see these guys named mentioned a few times, okay? We see their families mentioned, okay? Verse 25, let's start with Gershon, or the Gershonites in 25. This is what they were responsible for when Israel moved. Read 3:25. All right, so these guys were responsible for what? Where did they move? Took the tabernacle itself, right? The actual physical tent structure, the screen door in the front, like that was their job, okay? That was the piece that they had, okay? 29, the Kohathite family. 31, look at what they get to do. This is super cool. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you were a Kohathite, what unique duty did you guys have? You get to move the ark. You get to touch the utensils of worship. All the Levites couldn't do that. No other tribe could even do that. But if you were a Gershonite, you didn't get to do it. If you were a Merariite, I think that's how you would say their ites, okay, you had a different duty. Only the sons of Kohath got to deal with the table of showbread and the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, they were the only ones who were allowed to touch it. So, pretty cool job, right? Just note to self for later. These guys had a pretty sweet position and a very respected position and revered position amongst the family of the Levites and certainly amongst the whole tribes of Israel. They would have had a job that people said, man, that's pretty sweet, right? You get to carry the Ark of the Covenant. So, okay? Yeah, so when you see the cloud move or the pillar of fire move at night, when they packed up, their job was to make sure that those things were properly cared for and moved, and they carried them all throughout the wilderness, which I guess at some point would stink when you're like, dude, this thing's heavy. So, but you're not carrying babies or whatever else, so that was their job, okay? In a sense, they still had to conduct the operational system, and the tabernacle is going to be permanent instead of moving, so they still had to perform the duties of priests, but they didn't have to move it. So yeah, in that sense, absolutely. Okay, 36, here are the sons of Merari. Okay, this is what they had to move. These were the big bowed up dudes, apparently. So where do these guys move? Yeah, these are like the framers, right? So the guy, like when you hung the tent on all of the pillars that went around, that's what these guys took. So they were carrying the big lumber or whatever they used. So they had to carry big stuff. Now God's going to provide for them, I forget where it is, later. Like they get a cart, they get stuff to carry it on. Okay, so that's something with wheels actually. So God used, God provided for them. Okay, but those were the subdivisions of the Levites, and specifically those three families had kind of sweet jobs in regards to the tabernacle. Nobody else touched anything, okay? So just keep that in the back of your mind for later. We're going to see it again in the book of Numbers. That's the idea, okay? Chapter 4, this is interesting. God's going to give a command to the priests that we haven't seen before. Is that a question?
Yeah.
Or a double stretch? Yeah. Uh-huh. 2 Samuel 7. It's the story of Uzzah. We'll get there.
And were they not allowed to touch it?
Yeah. Yeah. The issue was the ark was not to be moved that way. It was moved by the wrong people in the wrong manner. And this guy with the best of intentions goes to study the ark because it had got jostled and God killed him instantly. Yes, and it wasn't supposed to be moved in the manor. The reason they moved it that way is because the Philistines moved it that way.
Okay.
And then David went back and said to God, like, basically, why are you so ticked? Finds the Levitical law and realizes, oh, that was stupid. This is how we need to move it. So.
That's because so much time has gone by that, like, it kind of gets lost in
yeah.
The
so.
During this time,
yep.
Like, right when it's established,
yep.
People would be so intense about doing it the right way.
Correct. Yeah, so think about it in those terms. 1446 is the year we're talking about. David ruled from 1000 BC to like 9, it was even higher than that, like around 1000 BC. So we're talking about 450 years later, right? Our nation's not that old. So yeah, think about how much got lost in that. But he finds the law and realizes, oh crud, like that's on me as the king. I blew that and I'm responsible for killing that dude. So, okay. It's a great story on, like, all passion and zeal for God, not linked to truth, and what happens with that. And then what happens when you swing the pendulum the other way, and it's all truth and no spirit and passion, right? Both of those extremes are not good, okay? And David is the guy that, right, he's zealous, he dances, he's, you know, his heart was in the right spot. But God said, don't do it that way. And I don't care where your heart is. I told you no, or I told the Levites no 500 years ago. Answer's still no, okay? So. But yeah, we'll get there, okay? Look at this with the priest. This is fascinating, okay? We loved this verse at the well 10 years ago. Now we're like, I don't know, okay? 4:3. This is God's order as to how the priests were to serve and how long they were to serve.
From 30 years old until the year's old, all who can come on duty, do the work in the tent of meeting.
Okay, so if you're, this is specifically... Who can minister in the Kohathite family? Like, if you're 18, can you carry the ark? God says, no. You have to be at least 30 before you can get into priestly service, okay? And then when are you done? 50, right? You're on the bench at 50, okay? Now, flip real quick to 8:24. Go to your right. Same context. We get a different number, though. Read 8:24. Twenty-four and 25. Okay, now when do they start in this text? 25. What do the other ones say? 30. Speculate. Why does one say 25 and one say 30?
Are they doing the exact same thing? Not two different things?
Nope, same thing.
Is it kind of like, hey, come along when you're 25, but once you're 30, it's, stranger.
I think that's exactly what it is. So from 25 to 30, you're being mentored. By who? How old would they have been? Over 50. So the guys that got put on the bench at 50, what is their job? I'm reading into this a little bit, okay? Don't take a bullet for this. So God says from 30 to 50, you can serve, okay? At 25, you come off the bench, but you watch. You're going to get discipled for 5 years as a priest. And potentially, it's either the guys that are currently serving, the 30 to 50-year-olds, or the guys that are forced into mandatory retirement at 50 to now to serve. Okay, why would God do this? Why did he put these regulations in there?
So that they weren't serving for 80.
Yeah, what happens if you got some dude serving at 80? For you guys, the young up-and-comers. There's no room. Like, y'all are hogging all the fun stuff. Like, you got to do it. I've told you guys the story before, but I heard a pastor say, I will retire when they drag my cold, dead body out of the pulpit. Like, that is a horrible plan of succession. Like, everybody underneath you wishes you would hurry up and die because there's no room for them to lead, right? Now, again, at the well when we started and we were all 24, didn't have any gray hair, man, this was awesome, right? But now that Brad has turned 40, you're like, man, like, what does that look like? Is there a time and a place where we need to say, listen, old farts, y'all need to get out of the way. And the young, up-and-coming men and women, the godly generation that's going to lead the next generation, maybe they need to do that. And yeah, maybe I wiped that guy's rear end when I babysat him 25 years ago, but maybe that's the next guy that needs to lead. Like, maybe God has gifted this person to lead the next generation, right? They say a great leader has impact 10 years below and 10 years above, right? I'm 38. Like, I don't hang out with 17-year-olds anymore, right? They get going when I'm going to bed. I don't know what they're doing, right? I don't have that influence anymore. Like, I'm barely able to even talk to a college student anymore, right? Now, I can hang with maybe a 50-year-old, and that's my world. Now, that feels very weird to me because I still feel like I'm 25, but I'm not. But the people that need to be ministering to them, I have a tendency, my generation has a tendency to look at them and say, oh, you don't know anything, right? You're dumb. But when I was their age, man, I was a know-it-all and I was ready, but we don't give them credit because somehow we get older, but they're not old enough. So until they're our age, that never happens, right? So it's fascinating. God had a mandatory plan of retirement. You work 20 years, and it seems that the older priests that had a ton of wisdom and a ton of experience would mentor the up-and-coming guys and say, okay, you're going to get to do these things. Do this. Be concerned about that. Don't do this, right? Yeah.
Even after retirement.
Yeah. Yeah. And the system all goes to pot when people stop worshiping God because then they stop tithing and now the priest has to go, mow lawns in the summer to, figure out how to pay whatever, right? They had to find a second job doing something. So, but it's fascinating to me that God built that in there. Now, that's not to say that we all need to retire at 50 or quit doing godly things, right? Moses ministered until he was 120. But I don't know where that balance is. But there needs to be. Y'all think about this now, right? You're on the front side of this and go, man, that's good. Y'all get out of the way because I'm a better leader than all of you anyway. Good. You should think that and do it, okay? But at some point, you're going to be my seat, Brad's seat, some of the older senior pastors around or whatever. They're like, man, there's going to be a point where I've got to set pride aside and hand the keys to somebody else that God is going to use because it's not about me and it's not about a person. It's about a movement and God can use kind of whoever he wants, okay? And not that those guys are need to go put out the pasture because they're useless. But there just may be a call for God to do things differently. Is that a hand? Just got it. You got the Layla stretch going on back there. Jazzercise in the back. All right. So again, I'm reading into that a little bit. I don't know for sure, but it's interesting that God kind of laid it out that way. Okay. You see more specifics in back to chapter 4 with the Kohathites. It names all the stuff that they're going to get. So it's all the utensils, right? The table of showbread in verse 7, the lampstand in verse 9, the golden altar in 11 where they would You know, barbecue, all the bowls, okay? That's, all those things are mentioned, okay? So that's the picture given, okay? And you get more detail with all of these, okay? 24, the Gershonites, all the stuff that they take, you get now even a deeper list of things that they were to take and so on and so forth. In 29, the sons of Merari, the things that they would have taken, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So, again, all the stuff that they're going to take. And all of this, again, like, just think about the detail of God in the midst of this, of how much he cares about order and things of that nature, right? So that's he is a very detailed, orderly God when it comes to things of this nature, so that the people know what to expect, okay? So let's do this. Let's stop there. And tomorrow we'll look at a really cool text in chapter, not tomorrow, Thursday, in chapter 6, the Nazirite vow, and kind of move on into now the journeys of the Israelites in the wilderness as they start moving. All right? Sound good? Fabulous.